smoker had gone out. I followed behind him and neither of us spoke. We stacked the filled supers onto the truck like the cat had our tongues, and neither of us said a word till we were back in the honey truck passing the city limit sign. Tiburon, population 6,502. Home of Willifred Marchant. "Who's Willifred Marchant?" I said, desperate to break the silence and get things back to normal.
"You mean you've never heard of Willifred Marchant?" he said. "She's only a world-famous writer who wrote 3 Pulitzer Prize books about the deciduous trees of South Carolina."
I giggled. They didn't win any Pulitzer Prizes.
"You better shut your mouth, because in Tiburon, Willifred Marchant's books are way up there with the Bible. We have an official Willifred Marchant Day every year, and the schools hold tree-planting ceremonies. She always comes wearing a big straw hat and carrying a basket of rose petals, which she tosses to the children."
"She does not," I said.
"Oh, yes, Miss Willie is very weird."
"Deciduous trees are an interesting topic, I guess, but I myself would rather write about people."
"Oh, that's right, I forgot," he said. "You're planning on being a writer. You and Miss Willie."
"You act like you don't believe I can do it."
"I didn't say that."
"You implied it."
"What are you talking about? I did not."
I turned to concentrate on things beyond the window. The Masonic Lodge, hot buy used cars, the Firestone Tire Store. Zack braked at a stop sign next to the Dixie Cafe, which sat practically in the front yard of the Tri-County Livestock Company, and for some reason this made me furious. What I wanted to know was how people ate breakfast, lunch, and dinner with the smell of cows, and worse, overwhelming their nose buds. I wanted to scream out the window, "Eat your damn breakfast grits somewhere else, why don't you? There's cow shit in the air!" The way people live their lives, settling for grits and cow shit, made me sick. My eyes stung all around the sockets. Zack crossed the intersection. I could feel his eyes bore into the back of my head.
"You mad at me?" he said.
I meant to say, "Yes, I most certainly am, because you think I'll never amount to anything." But what came out of my mouth was something else, and it was embarrassingly stupid. "I will never throw rose petals to anybody," I said. And then I broke down, the kind of crying where you're sucking air and making heaving sounds like a person drowning. Zack pulled over on the side of the road, saying, "Holy moly, what's the matter?" He wrapped one arm around me and pulled me across the seat to him. I'd thought the whole thing was about my lost future, the one Mrs. Henry encouraged me to believe in by plying me with books and summer reading lists and big talk about scholarships to Columbia College. But sitting there close to Zack, I knew I was crying because he had that one side dimple I loved. Because every time I looked at him, I got a hot, funny feeling that circulated from my waist to my kneecaps. Because I'd been going along being my normal girl self, and the next thing I knew, I'd passed through a membrane into a place of desperation. I was crying, I realized, for Zack. I laid my head on his shoulder and wondered how he could stand me. In one short morning, I had exhibited insane laughter, hidden lust, pissy behavior, self-pity, and hysterical crying. If I'd been trying to show him my worst sides, I could not have done a better job than this. He gave me a squeeze and spoke into my hair. "It's gonna be all right. You're gonna be a fine writer one day." I saw him glance behind us, then across the road. "Now, you go back over to your side of the truck and wipe your face," he said, and handed me a floor rag that smelled like gasoline. When we got to the honey house, it was deserted except for Rosaline, who was gathering up her clothes so she could move up to May's room. I'd been gone 2 slim hours, and our whole living arrangement had been overturned.
"How come you get to sleep over there?" I asked her.
"'Cause May gets scared at night by herself."
Rosaline was going to sleep in the extra twin bed, get the bottom drawer of May's dresser for her stuff, and have the bathroom at her fingertips.
"I can't believe you're leaving me over here by myself," I cried. Zack grabbed the hand truck and wheeled it out as fast as he could start unloading the supers from the honey wagon. I think he'd had enough female emotion for the time being.
"I'm not leaving you. I'm getting a mattress," she said,
and dropped her toothbrush and the red rose snuff into her pocket. I crossed my arms over my blouse that was still damp from all the crying I'd been doing.
"Fine, then. Go on. I don't care."
"Lily, that cot is bad on my back, and if you ain't noticed, the legs on it are all bent out of whack now. Another week and it's gonna collapse on the floor. You'll be fine without me."
My chest closed up. Fine without her? Was she out of her mind?
"I don't want to wake up from the dream world," I said, and mid-sentence my voice cracked and the words twisted and turned in my mouth. She sat on the cot I now hated with a passion because it had driven her to May's room. She pulled me down beside her.
"I know you don't, but I'll be here when you do. I might sleep up there in May's room, but I'm not going anywhere."
She patted my knee like old times. She patted, and neither of us said anything. We could have been back in the policeman's car riding to jail for how I felt. Like I would not exist without her patting hand. I followed Rosalina as she carried her few things over to the pink house, intending to inspect her new room. We climbed the steps onto the screen porch. August sat on the porch swing that was suspended from two chains in the ceiling. She was rocking back and forth, having her orangeade break and reading her new book, which she'd gotten from the bookmobile. I turned my head to read the title. Jane Eyre. May was on the other side of the porch, running clothes through the rubber rollers on the wringer washing machine. A brand new pink Lady Kenmore, which they kept out on the porch because there was no room in the kitchen. In television commercials, the woman who worked the Lady Kenmore wore an evening gown and seemed to be enjoying herself. May just looked hot and tired. She smiled as Rosaline went by with her things.
"Are you okay with Rosaline moving over here?" August said, propping the book on her stomach.
She took a sip of her drink, then ran her hand across the cold moisture on the glass and pressed her palm to the front of her neck.
"I guess so."
"May will sleep better with Rosaline in there," she said. "Won't you, May?"
I glanced over at May, but she didn't seem to hear over the washer. Suddenly, the last thing I wanted was to follow Rosaline and watch her tuck her clothes into May's dresser. I looked at August's book.
"What are you reading about?"
I asked, thinking I was making casual conversation.
But boy, was I wrong. "It's about a girl whose mother died when she was little," she said. Then she looked at me in a way that made my stomach tip over, the same way it tipped over when she told me about Beatrix.
"What happens to the girl?" I asked, trying to make my voice steady.
"I've only started the book," she said, "but right now she's just feeling lost and sad."
I turned and looked out toward the garden, where June and Neil were picking tomatoes. I stared at them while the crank on the washer squeaked. I could hear the clothes falling into the basin behind the rollers. "She knows," I thought. "She knows who I am." I stretched out my arms like I was pushing back invisible walls of air, and looking down, caught sight of my shadow on the floor. This skinny girl, with wild hair curling up in the humidity, with her arms flung out and her palms erect like she was trying to stop traffic in both directions. I wanted to bend down and kiss her, for how small and determined she looked. When I glanced back at August, she was still staring at me, like she expected me to say something.
"Well, I guess I'll go see Rosaline's new bed," I said.
August picked up her book, and that was that. The moment passed, and so did the feeling that she knew who I was. I mean, it didn't make sense. How could August Boatwright know anything about me? It was around this time that June and Neil started a first-class fight out there in the tomato garden. June shouted something, and he shouted back.
"Uh-oh," said August. She put down the book and stood up.
"Why can't you just let it be?"
yelled June.
Why does it always come back to this? Get this through your head. I'm not getting married. Not yesterday, not today, and not next year.
What are you scared of? Neil said.
For your information, I'm not scared of anything.
Well, then you're the most selfish bitch I ever met,
he said, and started walking towards his car.
Oh, Lord, said August under her breath. How dare you call me that,
said June.
You come back here. Don't you walk off when I'm talking to you.
Neil kept right on walking, didn't look over his shoulder once. Zack, I noticed, had stopped loading the supers onto the hand truck and watched, shaking his head like he couldn't believe he was witnessing another scene where people's worst sides come out.
If you leave now, don't plan on coming back, she yelled.
Neil climbed into his car, and suddenly June came running with tomatoes in her hands. She reared back and threw one, smack, right into the windshield. The second one landed on the door handle.
Don't you come back,
she yelled as Neil drove off, trailing tomato juice. May sank down onto the floor, crying and looking so hurt inside I could almost see soft red places up under her rib bones. August and I walked her out to a wall, and for the umpteenth time she wrote June and Neil on a scrap of paper and wedged it between the rocks. We spent the rest of the day working on the supers that Zack and I had hauled in. Stacked six high, they made a miniature skyline all through the honey house. August said it looked like Bee City in there. We ran 12 extractor loads through the whole system, all the way from the uncapping knife to the bottling tank. August didn't like her honey to sit around waiting too long, because the flavor got lost. We had 2 days to finish it up, she said. Period. At least we didn't have to store the honey in a special hot room to keep it from crystallizing, because every room we had was a hot room. Sometimes Carolina heat turned out to be good for something. Just when I thought we were done for the day and could go eat dinner and say our evening prayers with the beads, no, we were just beginning. August had us load up the empty supers and haul them out to the woods so the bees could come and do the big cleanup. She would not store her supers for the winter until the bees had sucked out the last remaining bits of honey from the combs. She said that was because honey remnants attracted roaches, but really I'm sure it was because she loved throwing a little end-of-the-year party for her bees, seeing them descend on the supers like they'd discovered honey heaven. The whole time we worked, I marveled at how mixed up people got when it came to love. I myself, for instance. It seemed like I was now thinking of Zack 40 minutes out of every hour. Zack, who was an impossibility. That's what I told myself 500 times. Impossibility. I can tell you this much. The word is a great big log thrown on the fires of love. That night, it felt strange to be in the honey house by myself. I missed Rosaline snoring the way you'd miss the sound of ocean waves after you've gotten used to sleeping with them. I didn't realize how it had comforted me. Quietness has a strange, spongy hum that can nearly break your eardrums. I didn't know if it was the emptiness, the stifling heat, or the fact it was only 9 o'clock. But I couldn't settle into sleep despite how tired I was. I peeled off my top and my underwear and lay on the damp sheets. I liked the feel of nudeness. It was a smooth, oiled feeling on the sheets, a set-free feeling. I imagined then that I heard a car pull into the driveway. I imagined it was Zack, and the thought of him moving in the night just outside the honey house caused my breath to speed up. I rose and slipped across the dark space to the wall mirror. Pearled light poured through the open window behind me, molding to my skin, giving me a true halo. Not just around my head, but across my shoulders, along my ribs and thighs. I was the last person to deserve a halo, but I studied the effect, cupping my hands under my breasts, studying my pinky brown nipples, the thin curves of my waist, every soft and glowing turn. It was the first time I'd felt like more than a scraggly girl. I closed my eyes, and the balloon full of craving finally burst open in my chest. And when it did, wouldn't you know? 1 minute I was dreaming of Zack, and the next I was hungering for my mother,
imagining her calling my name, saying, "Lily girl, you are my flower." When I turned to the window, there was no one there. Not that I had expected there would be. 2 days later, after we had run ourselves into the ground harvesting the rest of the honey, Zack showed up with the prettiest notebook, green with rosebuds on the cover. He met me coming out of the pink house.
"This is for you," he said, "so you can get a head start on your writing."
That's when I knew I would never find a better friend than Zachary Taylor. I threw my arms around him and leaned into his chest. He made a sound like, "Whoa," but after a second, his arms folded around me, and we stayed like that, in a true embrace. He moved his hands up and down my back till I was almost dizzy. Finally, he unwound my arms and said, "Lily, I like you better than any girl I've ever known. But you have to understand, there are people who would kill boys like me for even looking at girls like you."
I couldn't restrain myself from touching his face, the place where his dimple caved into his skin.
"I'm sorry," I said.
"Yeah, me too," he said.
For days I carried the notebook everywhere. I wrote constantly. A made-up story about Rosaline losing 85 pounds, looking so sleek nobody could pick her out of a police lineup. One about August driving a honeymobile around, similar to the bookmobile, only she had jars of honey to dispense instead of books. My favorite, though, was one about Zack becoming the ass-busting lawyer and getting his own television show like Perry Mason. I read it to him during lunch one day, and he listened better than a child at story hour.
"Move over, Williford Marchant," was all he said.
Honeybees depend not only on physical contact with the colony, but also require its social companionship and support. Isolate a honeybee from her sisters, and she will soon die. The queen must die, and other affairs of bees and men. Chapter 8. August tore the page for July from the wall calendar that hung by her desk in the honey house. I wanted to tell her that technically it was still July for 5 more days, but I figured she knew already. It was a simple case of her wanting July over with so she could start into August, her special month. Just like June was June's month, and May belonged to May. August had explained to me how when they were children and their special month came around, their mother excused them from house chores and let them eat all their favorite foods, even if it wrecked their teeth, and stay up a full hour later at night doing whatever their heart desired. August said her heart had desired to read books, so the whole month she got to prop on the sofa in the quiet of the living room, reading after her sisters went to bed. To listen to August talk, it had been the highlight of her youth. After hearing this, I'd spent a good amount of time trying to think up which month I would have liked to have been named for. I picked October, as it is a golden month with better than average weather, and my initials would be O-O. For October Owens, which would make an interesting monogram. I pictured myself eating 3-tiered chocolate cake for breakfast throughout the entire month, staying up an hour after bedtime writing high-caliber stories and poems. I looked over at August, who stood by her desk with the July calendar page in her hand. She wore her white dress with the lime-green scarf tied on her belt, just like she was wearing the first day I showed up. The scarf had no purpose hanging there, other than adding a touch of flair. She hummed their song. "Place a beehive on my grave and let the honey soak through." I was thinking what a good fine mother she must have had. "Come on, Lily," she said. "We've got all these jars of honey to paste labels on, and it's just me and you." Zack was spending the day delivering honey to her selling places all over town and picking up money from the previous month's sales. Honey money was what Zack called it. Even though the big honey flow was over, the bees were still out there sucking nectar, going about their business. You could not stop a bee from working if you tried.
Zach said August honey brought 50 cents a pound. I figured she must be dripping in honey money. I didn't see why she wasn't living in a hot pink mansion somewhere. Waiting on August to open a box containing the new shipment of Black Madonna labels, I studied a piece of honeycomb. People don't realize how smart bees are, even smarter than dolphins. Bees know enough geometry to make row after row of perfect hexagons, angles so accurate you'd think they used rulers. They take plain flower juice and turn it into something everyone in the world loves to pour on biscuits. And I have personally witnessed how it took a whole 15 minutes for about 50,000 bees to find those empty supers August had left out for them to clean up, passing along the discovery in some kind of advanced bee language. But the main thing is, they are hard-working to the point of killing themselves. Sometimes you want to say to them, "Relax, take some time off, you deserve it." As August reached down inside the box for the labels, I studied the return address. Holy Virgin Monastery Gift Shop, Post Office Box 45, St. Paul, Minnesota. Next, she pulled a fat envelope from her desk drawer and poured out dozens of a different, smaller label with printed letters. Black Madonna Honey, Tiburon, South Carolina. I was supposed to swipe the backs of both labels with a wet sponge and hand them off to August to position on the jars. But I paused a minute to take in the Black Madonna's picture, which I'd studied so many times glued onto my mother's little block of wood. I admired the fancy gold scarf draped over her head, how it was decorated with red stars. Her eyes were mysterious and kind, and her skin dark brown with a glow, darker than toast, and looking a little like it had been buttered. It always caused a tiny jump start in my chest, me thinking that my own mother had stared at this same picture. I hated to imagine where I might have ended up if I hadn't seen the Black Madonna's picture that day in the Frogmore Stew General Store and Restaurant. Probably sleeping on creek banks all over South Carolina, drinking pond water with the cows, peeing behind chinaberry bushes and wishing for the joy of toilet paper. "I hope you don't take this the wrong way," I said. "But I never thought of the Virgin Mary being colored till I saw this picture." "A dark-faced Mary is not as unusual as you think," August said. "There are hundreds of them over in Europe, places like France and Spain. The one we put on our honey is old as the hills. She's the Black Madonna of Breznishar in Bohemia." "How did you learn about all that?" I asked. She rested her hands and smiled, like this had dredged up a sweet, long-lost memory. "I guess I would have to say it started with my mother's prayer cards. She used to collect them, the way good Catholics did back then. You know, those cards with pictures of saints on them. She'd trade for them like little boys traded baseball cards." August let out a big laugh at that. "I bet she had a dozen Black Madonna cards. I used to love to play with her cards, especially the Black Madonnas. Then, when I went off to school, I read everything I could about them. That's how I found out about the Black Madonna of Breznishar in Bohemia." I tried to say Breznishar, but it didn't come out right. "Well, I can't say her name, but I love her picture." I swiped the back of the label and watched August fix it on the jar, then fasten the second label beneath it as if she'd done this 10,000 times. "What else do you love, Lily?" No one had ever asked me this before. What did I love? Right off the bat, I wanted to say I loved the picture of my mother, how she was leaning against the car with her hair looking just like mine, plus her gloves and her picture of the Black Mary with the unpronounceable name. But I had to swallow that back. I said, "Well, I love Rosaline, and I love writing stories and poems. Just give me something to write, and I will love it." After that, I really had to think. I said, "This may be silly, but after school I love Coca-Cola with salted peanuts poured in the bottle. And when I'm finished with it, I love turning up the bottle to see where it came from. Once I'd gotten a bottle from Massachusetts, which I kept as a tribute to how far something can go in life. And I love the color blue, the real bright blue like the hat May had on at the Daughters of Mary meeting. And since coming here, I've learned to love bees and honey. I wanted to add, and you. I love you. But I felt too awkward. Did you know there are 32 names for love in one of the Eskimo languages? August said. And we just have this one. We are so limited. You have to use the same word for loving Rosaline as you do for loving a Coke with peanuts. Isn't that a shame we don't have more ways to say it? I nodded, wondering where was the limit of her knowing things. Probably one of those books she'd read after bedtime during the month of August had been about Eskimos. I guess we'll just have to invent more ways to say it, she said. Then she smiled. Do you know, I love peanuts in my Coke too, and blue is my favorite color. You know that saying, birds of a feather flock together? That's how I felt. We were working on the jars of Tupelo tree honey, which Zack and I had gathered out there on Clayton Forest land, plus a few jars of purple honey from the hive where the bees had struck it rich on elderberries. It was a nice color coordination the way the Bohemian Madonna's skin was set off by the golds in the honey. Unfortunately, the purple honey didn't do a whole lot for her. How come you put the Black Madonna on your honey? I asked. I'd been curious about this from day one. Usually people got in a rut putting honey bears on them. August grew still, holding a jar in her hand and looking into the distance like she'd gone in search of the answer and that finding it had been the bonus of the day. I wish you could have seen the Daughters of Mary the first time they laid eyes on this label. You know why? Because when they looked at her, it occurred to them for the first time in their lives that what's divine can come in dark skin. You see, everybody needs a God who looks like them, Lily. I only wished I'd been there when the Daughters of Mary had made this big discovery. I pictured them whooping it up in their glorious hats, feathers flying. Sometimes I would catch myself jiggling my foot till I thought it might fall off my leg bone. Jimmy Leg, Rosaline called it. And looking down now, I noticed it was going at high speed. Usually it happened in the evenings when we did our prayers before Our Lady of Chains, like my feet wanted to get up and march around the room in a conga line. So how did you get the Black Mary statue in the parlor? I asked. I can't say exactly. I only know she came into the family at some point. You remember the story about Obadiah taking the statue to the praise house, and how the slaves believed it was Mary who had come to be among them? I nodded. I remembered every detail. I'd seen it 100 times in my mind since she'd first told it. Obadiah down on his knees in the mud, bent over the washed-up statue. The statue standing proud in the praise house, Our Lady's fist in the air, and all the people coming up, one at a time, to touch her heart, hoping to find a little strength to go on. Well, August said, going right on with her pasting. You know, she's really just the figurehead off an old ship. But the people needed comfort and rescue, so when they looked at it, they saw Mary, and so the spirit of Mary took it over. Really, her spirit is everywhere, Lily, just everywhere, inside rocks and trees and even people. But sometimes it will get concentrated in certain places and just beam out at you in a special way. I had never thought of it like that, and it gave me a shocked feeling, like maybe I had no idea what kind of world I was actually living in. And maybe the teachers at my school didn't know either, the way they talked about everything being nothing but carbon and oxygen and mineral, the dullest stuff you can imagine. I started thinking about the world, loaded with disguised Marys, sitting around all over the place, and hidden red hearts tucked about that people could rub and touch, only we didn't recognize them. August arranged the jars she labeled so far in a cardboard box and set it on the floor, then dragged out more jars. I'm just trying to explain to you why the people took such care with Our Lady of Chains, passing her one generation to the next. The best we can figure, sometime after the Civil War, she came into the possession of my grandmother's people. When I was younger than you, me in June and May, and April too, because she was still alive then, all of us would visit our grandmother for the whole summer. We'd sit on the rug in the parlor, and Big Mama, that's what we called her, would tell us the story. Every time when she finished, May would say, "Big Mama, tell it again." And off she'd go, repeating the whole thing. I swear, if you listened to my chest with a stethoscope, what you'd hear is that story going on and on in my Big Mama's voice. I was so caught up in what August was saying, I had stopped wetting labels. I was wishing I had a story like that one to live inside me, with so much loudness you could pick it up on a stethoscope, and not the story I did have about ending my mother's life and sort of ending my own at the same time. "You can wet the labels and listen," August said and smiled. So, after Big Mama died, Our Lady of Chains was passed to my mother. She stayed in Mother's bedroom. My father hated her being in there. He wanted to get rid of the statue, but Mother said, "If she goes, I go." I think the statue was the reason Mother became a Catholic, so she could kneel down before her and not feel like she was doing anything peculiar. We would find her in there talking to Our Lady like they were two neighbors having sweet iced tea. Mother would tease Our Lady. She'd say, "You know what? You should have had a girl instead." August set down the jar she was working on, and there was a mix of sorrow and amusement and longing across her face. And I thought, she is missing her mother. I stopped wetting the labels, not wanting to get ahead of her. When she picked up the jar again, I said, "Did you grow up in this house?" I wanted to know everything there was about her. She shook her head. "No, but my mother did. This is where I spent my summers," she said. "You see, the house belonged to my grandparents and all this property around it. Big Mama kept bees, too, right out there in the same spot they're in today. Nobody around here had ever seen a lady beekeeper till her. She liked to tell everybody that women made the best beekeepers 'cause they have a special ability built into them to love creatures that sting. It comes from years of loving children and husbands," she'd say. August laughed, and so did I. "Was your Big Mama the one who taught you to keep bees?" August took off her glasses and cleaned them on the scarf at her waist. "She taught me lots more about bees than just how to keep them. She used to tell me one tall bee tale after another." I perked up. "Tell me one," I said. August thumped her finger on her forehead like she was trying to tap one of them off some back shelf in her head. Then her eyes lit up, and she said, "Well, one time, Big Mama told me she went out to the hives on Christmas Eve and heard the bees singing the words of the Christmas story right out of the Gospel of Luke." August started to sing then in a humming sort of way. "Mary brought forth her firstborn child and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in the manger." I giggled. "Do you think that really happened?" "Well, yes and no," she said. "Some things happen in a literal way, Lily, and then other things, like this one, happen in a not literal way, but they still happen. Do you know what I mean?" I didn't have a clue. "Not really," I said. "What I mean is that the bees weren't really singing the words from Luke. But still, if you have the right kind of ears, you can listen to a hive and hear the Christmas story somewhere inside yourself. You can hear silent things on the other side of the everyday world that nobody else can. Big Mama had those kind of ears. Now my mother, she didn't really have that gift. I think it skipped a generation." I was itching to know more about her mother. "I bet your mother kept bees too," I said. She seemed amused at that. "Goodness, no. She wasn't interested at all. She left here as soon as she could and went to live with a cousin up in Richmond. Got a job in a hotel laundry. You remember the first day you got here, I told you I grew up in Richmond? Well, that's where my father was from. He was the first colored dentist in Richmond. He met my mother when she went to see him with a toothache. I sat there a minute and thought about the odd ways of life. If it wasn't for a toothache, Rosaline wouldn't be here, or May, or June, or Black Madonna Honey, and I wouldn't be sitting here talking to her. I loved Richmond, but my heart was always right here, she said. Growing up, I couldn't wait to get here and spend the summers, and when Big Mama died, she left all this property to me, June, and May. I've been here keeping bees nearly 18 years now. Sunlight gleamed against the honey house window, flickering now and then with a shifting cloud. We sat in a yellowish quiet for a while and worked without talking. I was afraid I'd tire her out with all my questions. Finally, I couldn't hold myself back. I said, "So what did you do in Virginia before you came here?" She gave me a teasing look that seemed to say, "My goodness, you sure do want to know a lot of things." But then she dived right in, her hands not slowing down one bit pasting labels. I studied at a Negro teacher's college in Maryland. June did too, but it was hard to get a job since there weren't that many places for Negroes to teach. I ended up working 9 years as a housekeeper. Eventually I got a job teaching history. It lasted 6 years till we moved down here. What about June? She laughed. June? You wouldn't catch her keeping house for white people. She went to work at a colored funeral home, dressing the bodies and doing their hair. That seemed like the perfect job for her. It would be easy for her to get along with dead people. May said June almost got married one time. That's right, about 10 years ago. I was wondering. I stopped, looking for a way to ask her. You were wondering if there was ever a time when I almost got married? Yeah, I said. I guess I was. I decided against marrying altogether. There were enough restrictions in my life without someone expecting me to wait on him hand and foot. Not that I'm against marrying Lily. I'm just against how it's set up. I was thinking, well, it's not just marriage that's set up like that. What about me waiting on T-Ray hand and foot, and we were just father and daughter? Pour me some more tea, Lily. Polish my shoes, Lily. Go get the truck keys, Lily. I sincerely hope she didn't mean this sort of thing went on in a marriage. Weren't you ever in love? I asked. Being in love and getting married now, that's two different things. I was in love once, of course I was. Nobody should go through life without falling in love. But you didn't love him enough to marry him? She smiled at me. I loved him enough, she said. I just loved my freedom more. We glued labels till we ran out of jars. Then for the heck of it, I moistened the back of one more and pressed it onto my T-shirt in the gully between my breasts. August looked at the clock, announcing we'd done so good with our time, we had a whole hour left before lunch. Come on, she said. Let's do Bee Patrol. Though I'd done Bee Patrol with Zack, I hadn't been back to the hives with August since that first time. I pulled on long cotton pants that used to be June's and August's white shirt, which needed the sleeves rolled up about 10 turns. Then I placed the jungle helmet on my head, letting the veil fall down over my face. We walked to the woods beside the pink house, with her story still pulled soft around our shoulders. I could feel them touching me in places, like an actual shawl. There is one thing I don't get, I said. What's that? How come if your favorite color is blue, you painted your house so pink? She laughed. That was May's doing. She was with me the day I went to the paint store to pick out the color. I had a nice tan color in mind, but May latched on to this sample called Caribbean Pink.
She said it made her feel like dancing a Spanish flamenco. I thought, well, this is the tackiest color I've ever seen, and we'll have half the town talking about us. But if it can lift May's heart like that, I guess she ought to live inside it. All this time I just figured you liked pink, I said. She laughed again. You know, some things don't matter that much, Lily. Like the color of a house. How big is that in the overall scheme of life? But lifting a person's heart, now that matters. The whole problem with people is they don't know what matters and what doesn't, I said, filling in her sentence and feeling proud of myself for doing so. I was gonna say, the problem is they know what matters, but they don't choose it. You know how hard that is, Lily? I love May, but it was still so hard to choose Caribbean pink. The hardest thing on earth is choosing what matters. I couldn't locate a stray bee anywhere. The hives looked like an abandoned neighborhood, the air groggy with heat. You got the impression the bees were inside having a big siesta. Maybe all that excessive work had finally caught up with them. Where are they? I said. August placed her finger to her lips, signaling me to be quiet. She lifted off her helmet and laid the side of her face flat against the top of the hive box. Come listen, she whispered. I removed my hat, tucking it under my arm, and placed my face next to hers so that we were practically nose to nose. You hear that? She said. A sound rushed up, a perfect hum, high-pitched and swollen, like someone had put the tea kettle on and it had come to a boil. They're cooling the hives down, she said, and her breath broke over my face with the smell of spearmint. That's the sound of 100,000 bee wings fanning the air. She closed her eyes and soaked it in the way you imagine people at a fancy orchestra concert drinking up highbrow music. I hope it's not too backward to say that I felt like I had never heard anything on my hi-fi back home that came out that good. You would have to hear it yourself to believe the perfect pitch, the harmony parts, how the volume rolled up and down. We had our ears pressed to a giant music box. Then the whole side of my face started to vibrate as if the music had rushed into my pores. I could see August's skin pulsating the tiniest bit. When we stood back up, my cheek prickled and itched. You were listening to bee air conditioning, August said. Most people don't have any idea about all the complicated life going on inside a hive. Bees have a secret life we don't know anything about. I love the idea of bees having a secret life, just like the one I was living. What other secrets have they got? I wanted to know. Well, for instance, every bee has its role to play. She went through the whole thing. The nest builders were the group that drew the comb. I told her the way they created hexagons, they must be the ones who could do math in their heads. And she smiled and said, yes, nest builders had true math aptitude. Field bees were the ones with good navigation skills and tireless hearts, going out to gather nectar and pollen. There was a group called mortician bees whose pitiful job it was to rake the dead bees out of the hive and keep everything on the clean side. Nurse bees, August said, had a gift for nurturing, and they fed all the baby bees. They were probably the self-sacrificing group, like the women at church socials who said, no, you take the chicken breast. I'm just fine with the neck and gizzard, really. The only males were the drones who sat around waiting to mate with the queen. And, of course, August said, there's the queen and her attendants. She has attendants? Oh, yes, like ladies-in-waiting. They feed her, bathe her, keep her warm or cool, whatever's needed. You can see them always circled around her, fussing over her. I've seen them caress her. August returned her helmet to her head. I guess I'd want comfort, too, if I did nothing but lay eggs all day long, week in and week out. That's all she does? Lays eggs? I wasn't sure what I expected.
It wasn't like she wore a crown and sat on a throne giving out royal orders.
Egg-laying is the main thing, Lily. She's the mother of every bee in the hive, and they all depend on her to keep it going. I don't care what their job is, they know the queen is their mother. She's the mother of thousands.
The mother of thousands. I put on my helmet as August lifted the lid. The way the bees poured out, rushing up all of a sudden in spirals of chaos and noise, caused me to jump.
Don't move an inch, said August. Remember what I told you. Don't be scared.
A bee flew straight at my forehead, collided with the net, and bumped against my skin.
She's giving you a little warning, August said. When they bump your forehead, they're saying, I've got my eye on you, so be careful. Send them love and everything will be fine.
I love you, I love you, I said in my head. I love you, I tried to say it 32 ways. August pulled out the brood frames, not even wearing her gloves. While she worked, the bees spun around us, gathering strength till they made soft wind on our faces. It reminded me of the way the bees had flown out of my bedroom walls, stranding me at the center of a bee whirlwind. I watched the different shadows on the ground. The funnel of bees. Me, still as a fence post. August bent over the hive, inspecting the frames, looking for wax buildup on the comb, the half-moon shape of her helmet bouncing alone. The bees began to light on my shoulders the way birds sit on telephone wires. They sat along my arms, speckled the bee veil so I could scarcely see through it.
I love you. I love you.
They covered my body, filled the cuffs of my pants. My breath came faster, and something coiled around my chest and squeezed tighter and tighter until suddenly, like somebody had snapped off the panic switch, I felt myself go limp. My mind became unnaturally calm, as if part of me had lifted right up out of my body and was sitting on a tree limb watching the spectacle from a safe distance. The other part of me danced with the bees. I wasn't moving a lick, but in my mind I was spinning through the air with them. I had joined the bee conga line. I sort of forgot where I was. With my eyes closed, I slowly raised my arms, weaving them through the bees, until finally I stood with them stretched out from my sides in a dreamy place I'd never been before. My neck rolled back, and my mouth opened. I was floating somewhere, somewhere that didn't rub too close against life, like I'd chewed the bark from a toothache tree, and it had made me dizzy. Lost in the bees, I felt dropped into a field of enchanted clover that made me immune to everything, as if August had doused me with the bee smoker and quieted me down to the point I could do nothing but raise my arms and sway back and forth. Then, without warning, all the immunity wore off, and I felt the hollow, spooned-out space between my navel and breastbone begin to ache. The motherless place. I could see my mother in the closet, the stuck window, the suitcase on the floor. I heard the shouting, then the explosion. I almost doubled over. I lowered my arms, but I didn't open my eyes. How could I live the whole rest of my life knowing these things? What could I ever do that would be good enough to make them go away? How come we couldn't go back and fix the bad things we did? Later, my mind would remember the plagues God had been fond of sending early in his career, the ones designed to make the Pharaoh change his mind and let Moses take the people out of Egypt. Let my people go, Moses said. I'd seen the plague of locusts at the movies, the sky filled with hordes of insects looking like kamikaze planes. Back in my room on the peach farm, when the bees had first come out at night, I'd imagined they were sent as a special plague for T-Ray. God saying, let my daughter go. And maybe that's exactly what they'd been. A plague that released me. But here, now, surrounded by stinging bees on all sides and the motherless place throbbing away, I knew that these bees were not a plague at all. It felt like the queen's attendants were out here in a frenzy of love, caressing me in a thousand places. Look who's here. It's Lily. She's so weary and lost. Come on, bee sisters. I was the stamen in the middle of a twirling flower, the center of all their comforting. Lily. Lily. My name came across the blue distances.
Lily!
I opened my eyes. August stared through her spectacles. The bees had shaken the pollen dust off their feet and were starting to settle back into the hive. I could see tiny grains of it drifting in the air.
Are you okay?
August said. I nodded. Was I? I had no idea.
You know, don't you, that the two of us need to have a good talk, and this time not about me, about you.
I wished I could do like the bees, just bump her forehead with a warning, tap it with my finger. I got my eye on you. Be careful. Don't go any further.
I suppose, I answered.
What about right now?
Not right now.
But Lily. I'm starved, I said. I think I'll go on back to the house and see if lunch is ready. I didn't wait for her to speak. Walking to the pink house, I could almost see the end of the line. I touched the place on my shirt where I'd stuck the Black Mary. She was starting to come unglued. The whole house smelled like fried okra. Rosaline was setting the table in the kitchen while May dipped down in the grease and brought up the golden brown kernels. I didn't know what had brought on the okra, since it was usually bologna sandwiches and more bologna sandwiches. May had not had a crying jag since June performed her tomato-throwing fit, and we were all holding our breath. After going this long, I worried that even something as simple as burned okra might send her over the edge. I said I was hungry, and Rosaline said to hold my wild horses. Her lower lip was plumped out with red rose snuff. The smell followed her around the kitchen like it was on a leash, a combination of allspice, fresh earth, and rotten leaves. Between the okra and the snuff, I could not get a decent breath. Rosaline walked across the back porch, leaned out the door, and spit a tiny jet stream across the hydrangeas. Nobody could spit like Rosaline. I'd had fantasies of her winning $100 in a spitting contest, and the two of us going to a nice motel in Atlanta and ordering room service with the prize money. It had always been my fond wish to stay in a motel. But at that moment, if you had told me I could have had my choice of luxury motels with heated pools and television sets right in the room, I would have turned it down flat for the pink house. There had been a few times, though, just after I woke up, when I thought about my old house, and I would miss it for a second or two before I remembered kneeling on the kitchen floor with grits digging into my kneecaps, or trying to step around a great big pile of T-Ray's nasty mood but usually landing right in it. I would remember him tearing into me, shouting, "Jesus H. Christ! Jesus H. Christ!" The worst slap across the face I ever got was when I interrupted him to ask just what did the H stand for anyway. One quick walk down memory lane, and the old home feeling would blow right over. I would take the pink house any day. Zack shuffled into the kitchen behind August.
"My, my! Okra and pork chops for lunch. What's this about?"
August asked May. May sidled over to her and said in a low voice,
"It has been 5 days since I've been to the wall." And I could see how proud of this fact she was, how she wanted to believe her days of hysterical crying were behind her, how this okra lunch was a celebration. August smiled at her.
5 days, really? Well, that deserves a feast, she said. And May, she beamed.
Zack plopped down in a chair.
Did you finish delivering the honey? August asked him.
Everywhere but Mr. Clayton's law office, he said.
He was fidgeting with everything in sight. First the placemat, then a loose thread on his shirt, like he was bursting to say something.
August looked him over. You got something on your mind?
You won't believe what people downtown are saying, he said. They're saying Jack Palance is coming to Tiburon this weekend and bringing a colored woman with him.
We all stopped what we were doing and looked at each other.
Who's Jack Palance?
Rosaline said. Even though we hadn't started lunch yet, she had bitten into a piece of pork chop and was chewing and talking with her mouth open. I tried to catch her eye, pointing to my closed mouth, hoping she'd get the message.
"He's a movie star," said Zack.
June snorted.
"Well, how dumb is that? What would a movie star be doing in Tiburon?"
Zack shrugged.
"They say his sister lives here, and he's coming to visit, and intends to take this colored woman to the movie theater this Friday. Not to the balcony, but downstairs in the white section."
August turned to May.
"Why don't you go out to the garden and pick some fresh tomatoes to go with our lunch?" she said, then waited till May was out the door. I could tell she was afraid Jack Palance trying to integrate the movie theater might ruin May's okra feast.
"Are people stirred up about this?" she asked Zack. Her eyes looked serious.
"Yes, ma'am," he said. "In Garrett's Hardware, there were white men talking about standing guard outside the theater."
"Lord, here we go," said Rosaline.
June made a pfft sound with her lips, while August shook her head, and it washed over me for the first time in my life just how much importance the world had ascribed to skin pigment. How lately it seemed that skin pigment was the sun and everything else in the universe was the orbiting planets. Ever since school let out this summer, it had been nothing but skin pigment every livelong day. I was sick of it. In Sylvan, we'd had a rumor at the first of the summer about a busload of people from New York City showing up to integrate the city pool. Talk about a panic. We had a citywide emergency on our hands, as there is no greater affliction for the southern mind than people up north coming down to fix our way of life. After that was the whole mess with the men at the Esso station. It seemed to me it would have been better if God had deleted skin pigment altogether. As May came back into the kitchen, August said, "Let's enjoy our meal," which meant Jack Palance was not a lunch topic. May plopped down 3 big tomatoes, and while she and Rosaline sliced them up, August went to the den and put a Nat King Cole record on the player, a machine so old the records would not even drop automatic fashion. She was crazy about Nat King Cole, and she returned with the volume up, frowning in that way people do when they bite into something and it tastes so delicious they appear to be in pain over it. June turned up her nose. She only cared for Beethoven and that whole group. She went and turned the sound down. "I can't think," she said. August said, "You know what? You think too much. It would do you a world of good to stop thinking and just go with your feelings once in a blue moon." June said she would take her lunch in her room. "Thank you." I guess that was just as well, because I was looking at the tomatoes May and Rosaline were slicing and rehearsing in my head how I would say, "So will you have some tomatoes, June? Don't you love tomatoes?" Now at least I'd be saved from that. We ate till we were tired out from eating, which is the way people in South Carolina eat at family reunions. Zack pushed back from the table, saying he was heading to Clayton Forrest's office to leave a dozen jars of honey. "Can I go?" I asked. August knocked over her sweet tea, a thing so unlike her. You did not associate spills with August. With May, for sure, but not with August. Tea ran across the table and onto the floor. I thought this might set May off, the tragedy of a spilled drink. But she only got up, humming "Oh, Susanna" without real urgency, and grabbed a towel.
"I don't know, Lily," August said.
"Please? All I really wanted was some time with Zack, and to expand my world by visiting the office of a real-life lawyer."
"Well, all right," she said.
The office was situated one block off Main Street, where Rosaline and I had paraded into town that Sunday more than 3 weeks ago. It didn't look like my idea of a law office. The whole operation was really a large house, white with black shutters and a wraparound porch, with big rocking chairs, which must have been for people to collapse into with relief after they'd won their cases. A sign on the lawn said Clayton Forrest, attorney at law. His secretary was a white lady who looked about 80 years old.